What's up, everyone? It's me again, Nate from Give Bats a Break. You're back with me for episode 4, the Halloween episode of the podcast that is for bats and their defenders. Let's go ahead and give bats a podcast.
I'm just a bat, but I like Batman. I'm often misunderstood.
The thing I'm realizing that I enjoy about editing these episodes is the inevitable realization that we've covered so much ground, and there's so much that I've forgotten, and so getting to go back and listen to them again is a second opportunity to glean more information from these conversations that we've had. This is the Halloween episode. We were talking about vampire bats, specifically their behavior, and my guest is Dr. Jerry Carter. You should know that we actually talked for about 4 hours during this conversation. Only a couple of those hours are in this episode, so it is my longest episode to date. But I hope it feels as quick to you listening as it did to me having it. So I will shut up now and enjoy this conversation with Dr. Jerry Carter about vampire bats and their behavior.
Yeah, I was surprised when I started to understand how many people study bats. I think when I was a kid, I thought, oh, there's probably like a dozen bat scientists or something.
Right?
Like, I just didn't realize the scope of it. I mean, my story is very similar to your story. I mean, I was really into bats when I was a kid, and flying foxes too. It was actually, real quick version. My dad was in the military, and then he was in the Peace Corps. Grew up in Queens, and then he was in the Philippines for his Peace Corps assignment, and that's where he met my mom. But my mom is actually from this indigenous headhunting tribe in the Philippines, and they eat bats over there. And so I went there a number of times, and the last time was when I was 2. And my earliest memory is a flying fox that was hanging somewhere, and it had a rubber band around its mouth, and the reason was because they were eating them. We were eating them. I probably ate that bat. I mean, it was they hunt them. When my mom was like a kid, she would climb up trees and like spear them or hook them with some stick, and so they ate flying foxes. And that's one of my earliest memories, was this image of this flying fox hanging somewhere. And I remember I was trying to like touch it or something, and somebody kept saying like, "No, don't touch that." And then years later, I must have been in first grade. There was like an animal encyclopedia, and I'm flipping, looking at the pictures. And then there's a picture of that flying fox, and I recognized the bat. And I just had this moment of like, I have a deep attachment to this. Like, and then I was just obsessed. I mean, I've been obsessed with bats since then. And I don't know what it is, something about the aesthetics of just the way they are. I don't know. But just my whole life since that point forward.
So in this case, interestingly, for some people, science is kind of what introduced them to bats. But for you, the bats are ultimately what led you into science. Would that be an accurate statement?
And yes. Yeah, I was obsessed with bats since I was a little kid. I was also really interested in nature, so I had all kinds of aquariums and terrariums, and I was out just, you know, I grew up in a pretty rural area. So I was always just sort of making observations of things, and I liked birds and all of this sort of like nature craft that a lot of kids get into. I was into all of that.
Where you grew up, was that in the Philippines or was that stateside?
No, I grew up in the Adirondacks. So my family moved, my dad is from Queens originally. My mom is from the Philippines. And then I was actually born in Long Island, where my grandparents live. And then when I was in kindergarten, we moved to a small logging town called Warrensburg in the Adirondacks. And so I grew up in like a very mountainous rural area.
Yeah. And was your realization that you wanted to work with bats, was that when you were flipping through that animal book and looking at the pictures, was it that moment? Or was it a moment, or was it sort of like a growing, like burgeoning reality, like a realization rather, that, oh man, this is what I'm going to do.
It felt like something really strange because it was, I mean, it actually goes back as far as I remember. Cause even when I saw that bat in the Philippines, I think that's my earliest memory.
Yeah.
And then the fact that I even remember, you know, seeing this picture of this bat in this animal encyclopedia from first grade. I don't remember anything else about first grade. I don't remember who my teacher was. I don't remember what we did. I just remember that. I just remember seeing the bat in the book. And then, you know, I was one of those kids that, like we were talking about earlier, I was just really into bats, and I was, I got Bats Magazine from Bat Conservation International. Yeah, I had the little bat fact brochures that, you remember those? They would fold out and they have facts about bats on them. And I'd go around and say, did you know that a little brown bat can eat this many, you know, mosquito sized insects in an hour? And
right.
Did you know that this, and actually bats like this. So I was just, yeah.
Really you were bats. The actually kid.
Yeah. I mean, people sort of knew me as this kid that's obsessed with bats.
Yeah.
And that just lasted pretty much all the rest of my life.
And here we are.
Yeah. It's like nobody's surprised if they find out what I ended up doing.
It's funny because, like, for me, I always thought that I would go back to you know, like a high school reunion as like Pastor Nate or like Father Nate or something like that. I never anticipated that I would go back as like Nate the Bat Guy, you know. Like, I don't think anybody else would expect that of me either, but Dr. Jerry Carter, bat specialist, would not shock anybody at your high school reunion, would it?
No, people would be like, well, you haven't changed at all.
Well, I saw that one coming.
I think I got interested in, I mean, I guess I was always interested in biology because I was always interested in nature, but I was more interested in sort of organismal biology and ecology than, I remember not being particularly interested in like genetics or anything medical when I took biology in high school. I thought I wanted to be maybe a forest ranger or a wildlife biologist, but somebody who was like working outside. That was the whole thing. I didn't want to be in a lab. That was the thing I remember. And then, yeah, I ended up, yeah, I got a scholarship to do research at Cornell University. And then this just completely changed the rest of my life, as I was going to go to a 2-year forestry school. And I got this, I don't remember exactly how this happened, but it was almost kind of like recruited or something. Like I had this, someone contacted me through some alum network or something, and I got the scholarship. And at the time, I started looking through Bats Magazine to find out if there were people who were studying bats at Cornell University. And there was a graduate student named Claudia Cohen. And there was an article about her in Bats Magazine called The Lore of the Vampires. And there's a picture of her holding like a handful of vampires. And she was looking at how they're specialized for different blood diets. And somehow I made a connection that she was still at the university. So when I went there and visited, I had a meeting with her. And she was sort of my first kind of research mentor. And then I got interested in a project to sequence the DNA of whatever the vampire bat had fed on to figure out what they had fed on, because nobody knows what these bats are feeding on, like out in the rainforest, you know, are they feeding on what wildlife are they feeding on? And so that's what I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do for my undergraduate project. And at the same time, there were a couple of researchers who were interested in locomotion bats and vampire bats in particular, because they can move really well on the ground. And there was a PhD student named Dan Riskin who was looking at how vampire bats move. He put them on a treadmill, and I was his field assistant. And so that was my whole introduction to research. And
you can find that in GIF form on Twitter if you're.
Yeah, interested. I mean, it went. I remember that moment because the original idea was at one point we were talking about having a climbing wall treadmill where the bat's like climbing, and we weren't sure if this would even work with the treadmill on the ground. And I remember Dan, we put like fruit bats on it, and they just sat there, and the thing just went backwards, and they
just rolled off the bat.
They just,
all those fail videos.
Yeah, and I remember when we put the vampire bat on that treadmill, and it just started, it was like walking, he sped it up and started running. Two things that happened. One is I think I passed out because I was so exhausted because I had been working day and night. Like I was helping them during the day, and then at night I was going out with these vampire bat people to capture these like hard to find bird feeding vampire bats called white winged vampire bats. And I just remember the day when we were first collecting data and I just like keeled over or something. But Dan, I remember him turning to me and being like, it's running. It's like running on the treadmill. You could see it switching from this walk to this run. And he's like, oh, It's like, this is amazing. It's like, this is going to be in Nature, you know, Nature magazine, which the biggest scientific publication. I think this kind of skewed my idea of how easy it was to do research because it wasn't that long. We showed up, we put a bat on a treadmill, and suddenly it's like this amazing discovery.
It was both the best and the worst thing. It was the best thing for the actual research and the worst thing for your expectations.
And so, yeah, that was my introduction to research. I was working in a bird lab to do my DNA sequencing. Mm. And that lab was actually, there's a really amazing people in that lab that were doing all kinds of things with behavior, but I didn't really appreciate it at the time. And then during my undergraduate, I took animal behavior. And then that's when I started getting interested in behavior as its own thing and evolutionary biology. And I sort of just switched from, I just want to be a person who wants to study bats. I mean, I remember at the time when I was working with Dan, I just wanted to be a field assistant. Like, I didn't actually want to do what he was doing, which looked really stressful. And he was always on his computer and analyzing data and being stressed about things. And my job was just like, I'm going to help you catch bats, like in the forest. And I just thought, I just want to do that. Like, I don't know if I want to go.
I'll do the Indiana Jones part.
Yeah, exactly. In the lab. Right. But that sort of changed by the end of my undergraduate. And then I actually did a master's based on observations of the bats that we had. So we had these common vampire bats, which are the ones that run on the treadmill. And then there were these white-winged vampire bats that we also put on the same treadmill and on these force plates. So Dan had made these things that were like bathroom scales, except super fancy. So when a bat walked across it, you could measure all the forces and the direction of the forces. So we put these white-winged vampire bats on these devices as well. And what we noticed with the white-winged vampire bats is that they called back and forth to each other. Like, one would call and the other one would call. The common vampire bats didn't do that, but they were calling back and forth all the time. And it was temporarily, it was coordinated. It was like a sort of duetting, like chirp, 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 back and forth, back and forth. And they were attracted to each other's calls. So to get them to walk across the force plates, we just put the one bat on the other side and the other one would go over there. So they were always just trying to like be together. And so I got really interested in that. And I decided to study that for my master's thesis. So I studied vocal communication in vampire bats. And then around that time, I was reading, actually during my undergraduate, I read this work about food sharing in vampire bats. And it was in a book, The Selfish Gene, the second edition of The Selfish Gene, which is just a really terrific book on evolutionary biology, but it talks about cooperation, the puzzle of cooperation. And the interesting thing there is that I had actually been interested in cooperation sort of philosophically and politically, which started in maybe like middle school or high school. I was really interested in human societies that, like the Amish, where people would come together and just like build a house. And it was just, everyone worked well, so well together as a community. I was really interested in what is it that makes certain groups of people work really well together? And what is it that in other societies, you know, cooperation has to be enforced top down, and how does that all work? And I think I was interested in these questions. I think I was really interested in socialism at the time. And like, what is it, what is human nature and how cooperative are people? And the whole question of the tragedy of the commons and public goods dilemma and the idea of, okay, well, if we all put money into this pot and then we can all get more money out, let's do that. But then the whole thing starts to break down because people cheat and they don't want to put money in, but they want to like free ride off of other people. And so this is like a common issue when you're looking at an economic system, is what prevents that. And so all that stuff I was interested in too. And so this idea of realizing that vampire bats are actually this model system to try to understand how an animal society could enforce cooperation is just like the perfect synthesis of two things that I was really interested in. So that's why I went.
How serendipitous, right? That like these two like apparently sort of disparate topics that you would never, well now obviously you would put them together, but like in middle school or high school or whatever, you would not have been like, you know, I'm going to look at vampire bats to see if I can find a perfect model for everything that I'm contemplating right now. That didn't happen, but somehow you kind of stumbled upon it and here you are. And it's like, how long have you been pursuing this line of thought now with vampire bats specifically?
I mean, I thought this was going to be a thing I was going to figure out in like the first year of my PhD. It's been, I don't know how many years, it's been like 15 years. I'm still studying. I mean, it's just the classic situation where you think you're going to study something and you're going to get an answer. And what you get are more and better questions that are that just like sharpen your thinking of like, what exactly do you mean by this? Like, right. How exactly does this work? Like, and then you go in and it's just, there's more details in there. And so what you get is a deeper and more interesting picture, but it's not necessarily like you just resolve this and you move on to something else. It just kind of keeps going. I mean,
every question answered, no more questions, moving on.
right. And so, yeah. The other thing about this topic so the original idea is vampire bats were this textbook example of what's called reciprocal altruism, which is the idea that I help you because you help me. And that's different than I help you because you might be related to me, say. And that was published, you know, in Nature magazine in 1984 by Jerry Wilkinson. And he did that for his PhD. And then he went on and did a bunch of other things, started studying like sexual selection of flies and these stock-eyed flies. He still studied bats, but he didn't come back to the vampire bats. And over the next 30 years, it just became this very controversial thing because people were interested in this idea of reciprocal altruism. It was originally thought to be extremely important. And then the pendulum swung in the other direction and people were like, we don't see this really anywhere. We think all of these cases where animals are supposed to be doing like a tit for tat thing, they're actually just following like some other simple rule, or they're not actually going out of their way to help each other, or they're just helping each other because they're related. And so there's all these other explanations, and the vampire bat one sort of, which was the classic textbook one, everyone started sort of taking shots at it and saying, what if this is just bats harassing each other? What if this is like the bats think they're related in this experiment? And that's why they were, you know, how much evidence was there really for this? And so right at the time I started my PhD, there was this kind of flip that had happened where this thing that was being used in an introductory class to explain what reciprocal altruism was, suddenly people were saying, reciprocal altruism is not a very good explanation for cooperation in animals. It might not even exist. And this case with the vampire bats, probably not true, or there's probably another explanation for it. And in fact, the textbooks had just changed. They went from saying reciprocal altruism is important and vampire bats are an example to reciprocal altruism is probably not important. And here's this example that people had from vampire bats, but here's why it's probably not real. So it was really perfect because I was coming along at this time where everyone was interested in knowing, like, have I been teaching this wrong? To all? Like, have I been telling a story that's not a true story? And then there was a sort of an audience on either side. So there were people who were excited because they said, I'm so glad you're going to finally take down this story, you know, and show what's really going on, because the vampire bats are not paying attention to who feeds them and then feeding the bats that feed them. I don't think that's what's happening. And then other people were saying, I'm so glad you're going to like really study this and
put down these naysayers.
Yeah, exactly. So I was agnostic. I didn't like, it was fine either way for me. I
mean, didn't know. I'm gonna learn and something. You're like, listen, I might not appease you. I might not appease you either. We'll see where the data leads us.
Yeah. And what was a little awkward is in the very beginning of my PhD, so my plan was to try to understand how vampire bats form new relationships by taking unfamiliar bats and then allowing them to form a new food chain relationship in captivity, which is something I eventually did like 10 years later. It took me 10 years to do it. So I finally did it. But this was my first attempt. You know, first year in graduate school, I had this grant money. I went down, there's like small grants, like $1,000 here, $1,000 there, enough to buy like a plane ticket. I went down to Trinidad and I caught these bats from different places. I put them together. And at the time I was communicating with Jerry Wilkinson. So I wanted to repeat everything that he was doing. And what I was seeing was that I put these bats and they stayed apart from each other. Then they started clustering. Then they started grooming each other. And then one would like start licking the other bat's face. So I would like fast them. I would start one overnight, put it back in there. It's the same thing that Jerry Wilkinson did. And I started watching it. And then I would zoom in with the camera and all I would see is a bat licking another bat's chin, like for a while. I did not see any, it was obvious they were not regurgitating blood into each other's mouths. So I asked Jerry Wilkinson, I was like, I started becoming skeptical about the whole thing. I asked him, how do you know the bats were sharing blood with each other? And he said, well, they cluster. And I was like, yeah. And then they get belly to belly. I was like, yeah. And then they sort of like put their wings around each other. I was like, yes. And then they get really close. And he's like, and then you'll be able to really see the blood passing. But you know, I had these like infrared scope, and I was in the field and everything. So you'll be able to capture it way better than I could. And all I just like watching these videos thinking like, is this just a giant mistake? Like, I mean, it's obvious that the mothers fed their offspring, but in terms of unrelated adults sharing food with each other, I just didn't actually see it. So I came back from the field and I just thought, I'm not sure this is, I don't know what to believe right now. And then I worked with, and so there's different I made a list of different hypotheses of what could be going on.
Yeah.
And Jerry Wilkinson, he sort of thought, well, you know, I had tracked these relationships for years. So he was in Costa Rica for like 6 years, and the bats that he had put in his captive experiment were ones that he knew were highly associated. Whereas I was like grabbing strangers. And then I also grabbed a bunch of bats all from the same tree and put them together, but I didn't see it then, but I didn't know what their relationships were. I didn't follow them for years beforehand. So he was just skeptical. And so one idea was that, well, if we went to a long-term captive colony, then if Jerry Wilkinson's right, they should all be sharing food with each other like crazy. But on the other hand, maybe they won't share food because they've never experienced not getting food. So I gave it a try, and they were sharing food like crazy. Like every bat that I fasted, I put back in there, and another bat would share food with it. And then when I got the when I looked at the DNA to get at relatedness of the bats, I mean, there was a lot of unrelated food sharing. I still was a little skeptical about how much of this was an artifact of captivity. And then when I went to Panama and then sort of did the exact experiment again, and then saw that, okay, if we capture wild vampire bats and put them together, even with strangers, we can watch how they develop new food sharing relationships. And so basically all of the stuff I've been seeing since I started has more or less been confirming what Jerry Wilkinson had reported. But we haven't done the perfect experiment yet, which I've been trying to do for 15 years, but still haven't done it, which is to actually control the relationships and basically look for evidence of partner switching or partner choice. Or in other words, we make a bat a cheat, you know, so these two bats are sharing food back and forth, and then this one suddenly is a defector and does not share food. And what we know is that if you do that, they don't respond immediately, but that kind of makes sense, because if you have a long-term relationship and somebody always, like, you know, gives you a ride to the office or whatever, and then one day they don't give you a ride, you don't go, well, I'm never talking to you again.
Wow.
Right? And so, right?
We're done.
you don't expect that necessarily the entire relationship's going to break down. These relationships existed for years between these bats. And I had, you know, prevented them from sharing food, and I didn't see that they just abandoned each other. But the question is, you know, would you at the beginning of the relationship see a bat choosing a more cooperative bat over another one? Or would you see a bat suddenly starting to switch away if this bat has just been unreliable over and over again? So those are the kinds of experiments we're still doing now. But in the meantime, I had done a bunch of experiments sort of testing all the alternatives. I mean, I was doing all of the ideas that people had put out there. So there was an idea that maybe they're just harassing each other. That's not true, like, because the donor initiates. If you trap a bat like in a little cage behind cage bars, an unrelated bat will come down and put its face against the cage bars to feed it. So clearly the bats are doing it to actually help the other bat. It's not just like, oh, I'm scared of you, I'm going to like regurgitate blood to you, which is one of the ideas. You know, another one is like, maybe they just don't know who their relatives are. But like, you know, in the wild, we've got bats with their kin and with non-kin, and they still feed non-kin. And we've got bats that we introduce as adults to each other. So it would be a really terrible kin recognition system to just say, if I meet a bat who I've never seen before my entire, you know, my life, and I spend enough time with this bat, suddenly I'm just going to treat them like family. Like, that makes no sense, because vampire bats don't live in family groups. They live in like a colony where they're surrounded by non-kin. So it doesn't make sense that they're just going to have some rule that just, and then another idea is like, maybe the bats just feed at the group level. So maybe every bat has a system where it's like, we're all just going to feed each other. And that's not the case. Every bat has its own network. Just like humans, you've got individuals that you're really close to and then other ones that you're distant to. And every individual has their own social network that's unique to them. It's not just like I treat everyone in my group the same. And that's very obvious that the bats have these individualized more like friendship-like relationships rather than a kind of group level. We all cooperate at the group level. There's another bat that does seem to act that way, the greater Spearnose bat.
Hmm. So is there any evidence that they can sort of like breach relationship with one another, or is that still the unanswered question? We're not sure about. We assume that that's probably what happens, but we don't know for sure yet.
Yeah, we have never destroyed a relationship between two bats. What we have done is created new relationships between bats and seen how those form. But what we hope to do is with a new captive colony is not necessarily try to like destroy a relationship quickly, but try to like shift the relationships around a little bit.
We hope to make them hate each other as quickly as possible.
Yeah, let's see if they sort of, if a bat has a network of bats is sharing food with, and then this individual over here is always there for you when you need them. And this one, every time you're hungry, suddenly they're hungry at the same time. Will you start diverting your investment, spending a little more time with that other individual?
Yeah.
And then the other one is like, if you're introduced to a panel of strangers and some of these strangers can feed you and other ones seem to never be able to feed you, are you going to try to form relationships with the more helpful strangers? Trying to measure this at the very beginning of the relationship, I think, is the key, because that's when the bats don't have a huge long social history, right?
So there's no pre-existing network or community to pull from. Yeah.
Right.
So how much does this, because there was an article that came out, what was that, beginning of July, about sort of the dominance within vampire bat communities, and finding that it's actually female dominated. How much of that ties into what we've been talking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, people have known for a while that they don't know for sure, but it looked like female vampire bats are just kind of, they're larger than the males, and they seem to be socially dominant because there've been so many observations of a male vampire bat feeding from a feeder or from an actual wild animal, and then a female bat showing up and just chasing this male off, and then not seeing that happen in the other direction. Mm. And so there was somebody in Germany that had a captive colony and mapped out the dominance interactions. And even the most dominant male that would just chase off the other males, like never aggress against a female. When the females show up, they would just chase them away. And it does seem to be that their social system in the wild is one where the males are fighting over. So it's often the case in mammals that you will get males that will try to monopolize your group of females. Mm. Like there could be a group of female deer, and then there's like one male deer that's like guarding the females, and other males show up, he chases them away. And vampire bats don't do that because it doesn't seem that they can really control a group of females. But what they do is they control a territory. But the females come and go from these territories. Like they just go wherever they want to, but the males will fight over the space and
the males will dominate the geographic spot. The
space, yeah, like a tree. Like I'm the male that's taken over the top of this hollow tree. All the other males are like being chased away or down lower down in the tree.
And but you can't control which females are there and whether they come and stay or go. Like the females are controlling the relationships where males are controlling the space.
Yeah. And then it doesn't seem that the females have these long-term relationships with each other, and the males, at least within those female groups, those males don't seem to have long-term relationships. They're mainly fighting with each other. And then, fathers and sons don't have any relationship because when a young male grows up in that colony, once he becomes a reproductive age, he gets chased out of he disperses and goes to a completely different population or site. And that's actually that's one of the ways that you don't have inbreeding. But that seems to happen because whoever's the dominant male will chase away those younger males. But the dominant male doesn't have what's called tenure. So he's not there for very long, and then there'll be a new dominant male at some point. And then even the dominant male does not father necessarily the majority of the offspring. So the females are mating with, many different males. It's not like the dominant male has like, I'm all of the offspring in this group are my offspring. That's not the case.
Yeah. That's interesting. What is the reproductive age in vampire bats?
It's, well, for the young males, they're leaving between 12 and 18 months. Mm. And then, so it's basically like there's a year of growth, and then the second year they're sort of still developing, and then after that they're adult.
Man, this just sounds so much like humans.
Yeah, they have for bats, they have an exceptionally long period of development. There's a really long gestation period. And then, so if you are a...
Isn't it like seven months or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. It's very long.
That's enormous.
Yeah, and then they will the parental care, maternal care, it just extends. It sort of gradually turns into a long-term relationship. So if it's a daughter, I don't know when you can say, oh, now the daughter's nursing, but then also getting these regurgitated blood donations. And then at some point it just turns into this kind of reciprocal relationship. But it what's strange is that I had gone with these captive colonies and been fasting everybody, including the mother. And I saw bats that were still nursing. So imagine an infant still nursing, but the infant is also feeding on some blood. So it's getting a mix of both. Mm. The mother, when the mother's hungry, the infant regurgitates her blood that she ingested to help her mom. I can't think of any other animal that would happen. If you think of an animal where it's like, it's nursing and it's like, oh, you didn't feed mom here. Let me give you some of my food that I got myself. Like, I mean, it's just fair. It's
comical to think of it like in any other context, really, or like especially in a human context, like just infant breastfeeding and mom's like, oh, I'm hungry, and baby's like, oh, don't worry, I got you.
right.
Oh, thanks, delicious.
Yeah, I mean, I doubt that happens in the wild ever, but the point is that they're capable of that, and yeah, it just shows you how long the development is. I mean, they're really nursing for a very long time.
Yeah. We're kind of getting back to the social structure. Who initiates? And like, so you've got two bats that don't know each other. They've just been introduced. They're perfect strangers. Essentially, they've got no prior context to pull from. How are they deciding? Is it just the first person to get hungry? The first night that one of them gets a meal and the other doesn't. Is that how it starts, or who initiates these relationships?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're trying to understand now. And it's hard to understand just from watching in the wild, because you don't... So what Jerry Wilkinson observed was that a new female would join like a social network of bats. Like every couple of years, there'd be one. So most of the bats that you have there are females that are being born in the group. So here's the social structure, basically. Imagine you've got different matrilines. So you've got grandmother, mother, daughter, and then you have got another grandmother, mother, daughter, and so forth. And those matrilines are not necessarily related to each other, but they're related within the matriline. And this right. is a common, this is just what you would get if you had all the males leaving and the females staying, is that's what you'd have. And it's very similar to a lot of other mammals, you know, like many primates, elephants, which just have this social system. But then in addition to this group of where the females have both family and non-family, you also have these females that will just show up, who knows where from where, but they show up and they join this group. That means they're not related to anyone in the group. Right. They don't have a family there. And so what happens with those? Somehow they get integrated in this group, and then eventually they start building their family. If they have a daughter, now they have a food sharing partner. But how do they integrate initially? And so that's what we're kind of simulating when we take these adult females and mash them together in captivity. So we just take different groups, put them together, or we might take like two individuals and put them together. If you take two individuals, you put them together, they form relationships really fast.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's no outgroup.
Right.
If you put a group of three bats from one group and a stranger in there, the stranger integrates, you know, not as quickly, but faster than if you put two groups. If you put two groups in there, everybody can just stick with their familiar bats. And so that's the situation. We have slowest development of new relationships, but they still happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you still see this like merging going on. And we've studied it over months, but in the case where we just put two isolated strangers together. I mean, it's like the relationships are starting to, you can see them like in hours or days. They're checking each other out. They start grooming each other. You can even see food sharing.
So you've got the one, you've got the three. And like, is there like an equivalent of like social anxiety or social awkwardness? Is that like kind of the equivalent of what we're seeing? Is there like, hi, I'm new here. It's sort of like this weird, I want to be a part of you. I want to sit with you at the lunch table, but I'm not sure that I can yet, kind of a thing. Is it the equivalent of that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's just like if you have dogs and you put them together and they, you know, it's one thing is that it's highly variable between individuals and highly variable between introductions. I had one introduction where I thought, I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to do this, because one of the first ones I did, I put the bat in a little like shark cage. Like, so it's in a little cage with the other bat. And this, the other bat basically attacked it, like jumped on the cage and was like screeching. It was like biting the bars. And so I just thought, oh, this is not going to work. Like, they're just going to attack each other.
Nope.
But then in other cases, I mean, that was just that one female, but then I put another female in that cage and she just goes and like sniffs. And he's like, hey, how's it going? And then I just get along. And I'm like, I don't know what's the difference, but those two hate each other and these two don't. And we did, there was something, we haven't published this yet, but I had an undergraduate go back and rewatch basically the first few hours. So when we first had these introductions, what happened? Like immediately, what happened? Did they start fighting? Was the one like chasing the other one away? Or did they just start sniffing each other and, you know, and then they're fine with each other? And the question I wanted to ask was, can you, without knowing the future of these bats, so we know from the long term, like we had them in captivity for almost 2 years, and so we know which ones eventually formed these strong relationships and which ones didn't. And I asked it, and the question was, could the undergraduate tell which ones were going to form relationships and which ones weren't, just from their first impressions of each other? And the answer is not really. Mm. We didn't know. It wasn't like these two bats were just like, I hate you. That's it for the rest of time. we didn't see any real strong patterns. So I really do think that the relationships are not something that's just based on the immediate. I think there is probably a correlation between your first impression and your long-term social history or trajectory, but it's not so strong that it just popped out. You know, it's probably pretty subtle. And I mean, if you think about human relationships, there's just a lot that happens between when you first meet. I mean, sometimes you meet a person and you're just like, oh my God, you're my best friend we're best friends forever.
Right.
But sometimes you meet someone, you go, hey, nothing happens. And like, because you're sort of at the same place and the relationship develops slowly. And that's kind of, we're trying to understand that process. What does that look like? What we think is going on is that the bats make small investments at first. So they see each other. And then the first question is just, are you even like a safe individual to be around? Like, could I just hang out next to you and you're going to be fine with that? And then you see how that goes. And then the idea, this is called testing the waters or raising the stakes. So maybe I'll cluster next to you. Like, it's kind of cold, so maybe I'll just cluster with you for warmth. We both get a little bit of warmth. You know, that's not asking a lot.
Right.
Maybe I'll groom you just a little bit. And the thing about grooming is that you can see how the other individual responds to your grooming. So either they shy away from you, or maybe they start grooming you back. A lot of the grooming in vampire bats is mutual grooming. They're both grooming each other at the same time. Mm. And so you can immediately get a sense of which individuals you're going to get along with and which ones you're not. And what we see is a kind of pattern where the bats are ramping up their relationships that way before they start doing things like regurgitating food to each other.
Yeah.
So that's what we think that's our working hypothesis, is that bats make small investments and then increase those investments in time with certain partners, and then other ones where they're getting negative feedback, they sort of say, well, I'm going to prefer to be around the individuals that I have this nice positive feedback from.
Right. So they have to pass successively more complex vibe checks as
they Yeah. That's what we think. Yeah. So we're still studying this.
Nudge up to them. They nudge back, pass right. The vibe check. Next thing, right. Let me lick them.
let's see how this goes.
That's really cool. Man, it is so crazy, like how, what's the end goal? Like, where, so the research Like, is there a real world application or like explanatory power for any of this that kind of goes beyond the study of vampire bats? Are we trying to use this to actually explain from an evolutionary standpoint human behavior, or like what's beyond the horizon of vampire bats specifically when it comes to what you're studying?
Yeah, so the overall theory here, there's a lot of theory that comes out of studying the evolution of cooperation, you know. So, and this is a really big topic. It spans like all of evolutionary biology, because you've got, you know, cells cooperate within the body, you've got individuals cooperating in society, you've got genes cooperating within the genome, and you've got members of different species that are cooperating. And in all of these situations, the fundamental puzzle is like, what prevents cheating? Like, you know, you groom me, and then when you need grooming, I don't groom you. And so I can exploit your cooperation. Or another way to think about it is cooperation creates a public good that sort of can allow free riders to proliferate. And there are many solutions to this. But you could basically think of them as like, there's a number of solutions that basically involve the organisms enforcing cooperation. So reciprocity, reciprocal altruism is one example. I'm going to stop feeding you if you don't feed me in return. That's right. One possibility. Or another one is a kind of assortment. So like all the cooperators just find each other and kind of assort, and they get away from the other individuals. And then that also can make it stable. Or kin selection is another example. So I'm just going to help my family members. They have the genes for these cooperative traits. And so families that are cooperative will form these nice lineages, and families with psychopaths will die out because they don't raise each other. You know, they don't help each other. The offspring die. It's just, you know, and so that's we know that that is true. And so all of these forces are playing. It's probably the case that many of these things are playing roles, and that they can even be working together and sort of working synergistically with each other. Mm-hmm. And then specifically when it comes to the topic of reciprocity, it's very controversial. And I think the reason it's controversial is that we have a very binary way of thinking about it. The question is, this is the controversy, like in a nutshell. When people look at a situation where one animal is helping another, like a chimpanzee is grooming another chimpanzee or giving another chimpanzee food, and these individuals have a relationship. Some scientists look at that and say, well, they're just not really in competition with each other. So there's nothing to regulate. You know, they're just, what does it cost to groom another chimpanzee? So there's no cheating that's even possible. Cheating is not possible. This is just a kind of mutually beneficial thing that both individuals can engage in it. There's no problem to sort out. Other people look at that situation and think, this is a situation of a high potential conflict. You know, these chimpanzees, they could kill it. Sometimes they kill each other. You know, sometimes a friendship turns into a situation where one individual, you know, kills, and this has been observed in some chimpanzees where there's a dominant alpha male that has a sort of coalition of other males. And then one day they like turn on him and just like execute him and like take over his position. And so the other way to look at these relationships is to say relationships are full of conflict and full of competition. And there's all kinds of mechanisms that suppress that. And that gets amazing as this might seem, this actually gets posed as basically a binary option, like it's one or the other.
Yeah.
So people will say the cooperation is being enforced by a tit for tat mechanism, in which case like reciprocity is necessary to stabilize this. Or the other possibility is that it's what people will call sometimes pseudo reciprocity. So it looks like reciprocity, but it's actually not, because it doesn't matter if you feed me when it's my turn to be fed. So I'll feed you and maybe you feed me, but maybe you don't. I don't really care either way because it doesn't cost me that much. That's the other scenario. And so people have been fighting about different cases about which one of these things is right. And my take on it is that it's a continuous spectrum. And as a relationship progresses over time, it could be moving back and forth across this. Like the amount of conflict in the relationship can sort of ebb and flow. And I do think it's foolish to think that there's no conflict in relationships at all. I think that it's probably the case that there's pretty much conflict in every relationship, even ones where there's high like interdependence. But at the same time, it's not the case that the conflict is just total, right? there's some combination of we're in some conflict, but also we have so many reasons to want to help each other, and trying to figure out exactly where we are on that spectrum and where different species are and what are the forces that push a relationship from cooperation to conflict or back, and how much of that is being regulated versus just it doesn't need to be regulated because it's just not important. I mean, to take an example with humans, you can think about people who are highly interdependent. So like a couple raising kids, right? So my wife and I, right? So we've got every reason to work together to raise our offspring. And yet, is there like conflict? Is there like negotiation and like,
nope,
who's
none. Yeah, none.
Right. So, and what's interesting here is if you think about the way that conflicts manifest in a social relationship, it's often very subtle, and it's not even necessarily like, so for instance, you're talking, you know, if I'm talking with my wife and which everything's going well, and she might say, you know what, I'm upset at you because you haven't done X, you haven't taken out the trash or done this thing that I expected of you. In other words, I'm sort of calling you out as a defector. What's amazing is that, let's say a minute before this moment, if someone was to ask me, do you feel like there's anything unfair in the relationship? And I would be like, no. But as soon as I'm accused of something, and this is true of a lot of people, I'm suddenly like, well, you know what? You didn't do this. It's like right. My mind is so, how quick are we to like immediately jump? And it's like, we suddenly have a tally that just appears out of nowhere. Of
a all scroll the that we just like, yeah. Just like, exactly. Let me lift the ways of right. What and you've so, done.
Yeah. And that's just there. We don't have to think about it. There's all of the things that all of these conflicts can come to the surface. And it's almost like it's in our subconscious. I think we subconsciously are keeping track of our relationships. And there's a sense in which we're tracking how well we are doing a kind of emotional scorekeeping of relationships. And we have a sense of whether this relationship, we're kind of irritated. Like every time I wanted to, you know, I needed this thing for my friend, like they were never there for me. And I think that weighs on a relationship. And then those things are affecting relationships. Even though if you were to ask people, you might get a different picture, and that people might even be a bit dishonest with themselves. If you go and if, for instance, you go to all of these societies all around the world and you talk about friendships and sort of groups level cooperation of people, and everybody agrees that like, there's nothing contingent. Like I help my friend unconditional. It's just the same thing. If you were to ask me, you know, how much do you support your wife? Unconditional. It's unconditional. It's 100%. It's absolute. There's no conflict, but there actually is this subtle. There actually are these subtle conflicts, and there are times when we sort of think, you know what? I'm not gonna go hang out with my friend and do this and help them with this thing because they weren't there for me. So I think that's it's like trying to understand how these things. The big question is, you know. Do animals regulate their relationships or not? And if so, do they do it in these subtle ways that we don't understand because it's not this like obvious thing where one hits the other over the head? I think my working hypothesis is that there's a lot of relationship regulation that's going on in like these non-human primates and in these vampire bats and possibly in many other group living animals that have individualized relationships like elephants and hyena and that it's not necessarily a case of just categorizing them as like this animal's doing reciprocal altruism or this animal's doing byproduct mutualism is what it's called, but something where it's like a kind of messy intermediate and trying to come up with more nuanced understandings of how animals get along with each other. And so that's the question within the study of animal relationships.
Yeah.
And then that feeds into this larger theoretical picture of just how important is enforcement in general in cooperation. And the emerging picture is that it's very important at every level that I mentioned, from cells. So cancer cells are showing up all the time in your body, and cancer is a breakdown of cooperation. It's a cell basically saying, screw like doing working for the greater good of the body. I'm just going to do what I like to do and start replicating and just do what cells do. Like just you know, make many copies of my DNA. Who cares about the larger society of cells that I'm in? So that's really what cancer is. And what cancer is suppressed because the other cells are working together to constantly punish those cells. If you go into an ant or a bee colony, you know, people used to think that ants and bees were just all altruistic, and then there's a queen and they all help each other because they're a big family and they get along. And to some extent, that's true, but it turns out that it's actually enforced in many of these societies. The workers try to reproduce and then they get punished by the other workers. Every worker is enforcing cooperate. They're policing each other. And that's what's called worker policing. So the colony is actually full of potential conflict, potential cheating, and it's all being suppressed within the colony by other workers. Workers
not,
are not only
top down. It's like peer to peer.
Yes. Yes. So the workers don't want the other workers laying eggs. That's what they don't like that. And so they'll kill the eggs. Or
and is it like, is it from a position of like, if you're not working, then I'm working more and I don't want to work more. So like, can we get that granular and like the motivation of it? Is there anything that we can really call motivation when it comes? Well, I guess so. It's survival or not, but
yeah, I think in those cases, it's not psychological mechanisms. These are just things that are hardwired into the ants. I mean, ants are very chemical. So they make a lot of decisions based on, you know, chemical cues. And so there's animals that trick ant colonies by, if they have like the right chemical, the ants will treat them like a giant ant, you know, like caterpillar will go in there and they'll be feeding it. They think it's an ant. So these are not like, it's not like the ants like reasoning, like, I don't feel like this is fair, you know, like, right. But the point is that could be happening in other species, like in primate species. It's possible that they are in fact weighing. We know humans do this. They're weighing some cooperative decisions might be very calculated, right? Like saying, I'm only going to help you if you help me. But I think for the most part, that's not very important. In most animals. I don't think it's very important in people. I think you have to be, there has to be something a little wrong with you if that's how you actually negotiate your social relationships, is you're actually like taking like it's calculated. I think what it really is kind of people call it emotional scorekeeping, or kind of you have a kind of sense of how much a relationship is, how much you like it or don't like it. You know, just like you have a sense of how much you like or don't like a particular person. And what you're doing is you're integrating all kinds of information about them. You're not even aware of what all those things are, but all of that gets put together and then you make a kind of decision based on that. And I think that's probably how reciprocity works in most species.
Yeah, because there's, as a human, I see another human in need. And again, starting with no prior relationship, just the fact that they are another human, related or not, I don't know. But there's a person needs my help. I have a sense of pity, or perhaps like a moral compulsion at some level to help them. Whether or not it comes back to me in any positive way, I just feel like, gosh, I got to do something for them. And so much of this is sort of couched in this language of like virtue, morality. Does that framework, I feel like we can't talk about a lot of this stuff from outside of that framework, like so much that language applies to what we're talking about, but sort of the underlying reality of that language, is that also present in these animals as well? And like at the level of the cell, maybe not, right? So like your example of like cancer cells earlier, and like how other cells are like policing, like they're basically rebelling. Well, not really rebelling, because like how can a cell actually rebel in the true sense of the word rebellion, right? And the other cells are policing them and like punishing them essentially. Well, it's not really actually punitive in the way that we talk about things being punitive, right? So it's like at what level does some of that language actually take on sort of the form for it to mean actually something closer to what we mean when we talk about things like pity and, you know, like,
yeah.
do we know? Is that something that can even be answered?
Yeah. I mean, and people have thought a lot about this. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is if you think about the moral emotions that we have, or the sort of emotions like sympathy and empathy, pity, that lead to us doing good things in the world, they're very biased in very curious ways. And so for instance, if you see and hear a child in front of you that's starving to death, you'd have to be a monster to not do something about it.
Sure.
But if you receive a pamphlet that says, here's a child that's starving to death, you're like, oh, okay, yeah. You just go about your, you ignore it. And the more children you add to that pamphlet, the less likely you are to do something about it. You're more likely to make a donation to help a child if it's one child. If somebody tells you, hey, there's 50 children that need, you're like, oh, okay. And it's like, you're less likely to do it. And why would it make a difference if the child's physically in front of you or, you know, somewhere off in a distant country, but someone's telling you they exist?
The reality is the same, whether they're here right on paper or here in front of you.
Yeah. And I think the way to think about this is that, you know, and this is true of other animals, is that, you know, evolution basically has built these sort of, there's a kind of strategy built into our emotions of like, in these kinds of situations, you should help. And in these kinds of situations, you shouldn't help. And if there's situations that are evolutionarily just don't even make sense, like a person that's far away, you know, like we're not good at cooperating under really unnatural circumstances. We don't, this is like when you go on Twitter and everybody's being like so crazy to each other, we don't have all those cues. We don't see the people, we don't, right? People cooperate in this way that is like a kind of, this is the way you would need to function in a human world where we all know each other, we all hang out with each other. And if you were, you could go too far in that direction. So you could imagine taking people's, like think about how people are just generally. Like people are pretty nice and pretty amazing to each other and pretty cooperative. Like we're maybe the most cooperative species in terms of how flexible we are. But you could imagine turning this dial up and suddenly we become very easy to exploit. If I just, every time someone asks me for money, I just give them money, I'm going to run out of money because I'm exploitable. So you turn the dial of niceness too high. Or if every single person that I meet, I have this immediate emotional attachment to where I'm like, I will risk my life for you always.
I will die for you.
Yeah. Then what you're doing is you're increasing the chance that those individuals are going to be exploited by other people. And so there's a certain amount that we're cautious. We don't overextend ourselves. But if you go too far in the other direction and you end up a person that only cares about themselves or is a psychopath, is totally Machiavellian. Everything they do has to be has to have some, you know, advantage for them.
Yeah.
Then you start going in the other direction. People don't like you anymore. So you don't function. And so I feel like our moral emotions are sort of fine tuned to being able to navigate a world where we have to make friends and cooperate with people, but not be exploited by nasty people. And negotiate relationships in a balanced way to form relationships that are fair and where we like help people when they're in need, but we also don't become suckers. And so that's how I kind of see this. So there's two levels there. There's the level of the motions, the proximate cues that drive us, that compel us to act in a particular situation. And what are those cues? And we can study what those things are for different animals. And sometimes they can be extremely simple. Like in some birds, anything in my nest, I will feed that thing. It doesn't matter if it doesn't even look like a bird. You know, there's like some animals are making decisions based on extremely simple cues. Mm. And then other animals are making quite nuanced decisions. They're comparing different options and they're saying, you know what? I noticed that this individual, you know, so I mean, classic example is that I love is the experiment done with these monkeys where they took two low-ranking, these are vervet monkeys, the two lowest-ranking monkeys, and they knew they're low-ranking because these are monkeys where they would groom other individuals a lot, but other individuals wouldn't groom them. It's very unfair. They're like the bottom of the dominance hierarchy and the popularity hierarchy. And then what they did was they put a little treasure chest of food where when this monkey goes up and tries to open this treasure chest, it opens and there's food for everybody. But any other monkey is incapable of opening this treasure chest. So this monkey has suddenly gone from being the low ranking monkey to the only monkey in the group. Yeah. And exactly. It's exactly what you'd expect. All the other monkeys are like, I really like you now. And they start grooming this monkey.
You are a god among monkeys.
Yeah. Suddenly this monkey's popularity skyrockets in the population. And right. So this monkey has a monopoly on the ability to do this. Then they gave the ability to another low ranking monkey. And just like you'd expect, the popularities equalized. So this one's popularity went down as the other ones went up until they were roughly equal and they were both more popular than, you know, average. And so what this is showing is these monkeys are aware of the basically like the partner value of these other monkeys. And they're making a decision that you weren't useful to me before, but now I see that you have this ability to do something that no other monkey can do. So now I want to hang out with you. And I think, so you've got the full spectrum of things, decisions based on very simple rules and decisions based on weighing the relative ability of different individuals in the group to do something.
Yeah. Well, and that's so, and this kind of ties into to my next question. Like there's, when we talk about bats often, it's in terms of like the benefits that they provide to us, right? It's like when we're trying to convince other people that like, hey, you probably, did you see that article that I shared earlier? There was a random tourist that showed up to Carlsbad Caverns. They found a wooden stake left like in this auditorium outside of the cave where presumably somebody had shown up with the stake to kill vampires. I don't know exactly. You know, like, that probably, I don't know if they were like, I'm going to leave this behind and people are going to go crazy. Or if there was somebody that was actually there to like kill them, to kill the bats. But like, you know, like when we're trying to talk people off the ledge of like, you don't need to kill bats. A lot of the times it's in terms of the ecosystem services that they provide. It's like it's very anthropocentric, right? But something I tagged you in a comment, on Twitter last week or a couple weeks ago about vampire bat populations and whether there'd been any studies done on how they fluctuate or whatever. And you said that you didn't know, but you said, I would guess that vampire bats are more abundant now than ever due to increasing livestock abundance, that they're perhaps the only bats that have benefited from human activity. Can you expand on that maybe just a little bit more? Like, because I think actually somebody else came back and said, gave some other examples. Twitter did what Twitter does, and we got some counter examples there.
But of other bats benefiting from people.
Yeah, but in vampire bats specifically, how is it exactly they benefited? Is it this livestock abundance? Is it farming that has helped them out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the conquistadors brought horses and cows throughout Latin America. I mean, it's just become the thing that vampire bats feed on. If you want to catch vampire bats, you go where there's livestock. And if you find some vampire bats and you look at what they're feeding on, they're probably feeding on livestock. So you also find vampire bats feeding on aggregations of other kinds of large, like sea lions or something on a beach. So they'll go after anything. They'll go after wildlife. But I mean, think about how easy it is to get blood out of a cow versus, like before I told you about, or I mentioned this thing about a mountain lion with a vampire on it. I mean, like if I was going to try to bleed a mountain lion versus a cow, a cow is about is like the perfect meal for vampire bat. They're just these giant blocks where a vampire bat can just land on a cow and just run around on a cow. It's like a feeding station. And what can cows do? I mean, they can kind of like move around like this.
They just flip their tail to one side and the other.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're pretty defenseless. And so, and they're stable aggregations of food. And so a lot of people think that, you know, vampire bat populations are just huge and larger than they would be if you didn't have livestock. I mean, there's, and livestock, I mean, there's a lot of livestock. I mean, there's more livestock than all other wild mammals combined. I mean, there's probably more cows of biomass on the earth than all other. I mean, we don't really think about it, but there's just a lot. And so the vampire bats are able to make use of this novel resource in the same way that like, it's like a new niche that's formed. It's just like animals that live in cities and are feeding on like rats feeding on like, you know, food garbage. That's essentially the situation that vampire bats have found themselves in.
Yeah. Which good for them. Like, glad that we're finally glad that we were able to do something good for them rather than the other way around. As far as bats and them evolving blood feeding, Glover Morrill Allen proposed the possibility that vampire bats might have first been fruit juice drinkers who later learned to puncture the flesh rather than fruit and then secure the juices. Does this theory have any legs in your reading or in your estimation?
There's different hypotheses. That's one. That seems like to me the one that makes the least sense. But there's also, I mean, but none of these are very, these are all just speculation. So another one is the idea that bats are feeding on things that are feeding on large animals, like a bat, it's feeding on a blood feeding mosquito or tick or horsefly or something, and then just goes from that insect straight to the instead of feeding on the blood feeding insect to get the insect with just a bag of blood, why not just cut feed directly the on the or another possibility is that, you know, animals can have these wounds and then the wounds can have insects in the wound, like maggots grown in a wound or something. The bats goes there and is basically a gleaning bat that's getting these things and then just starts feeding on the wound. Other people have thought that vampire bats might have evolved from some kind of proto, like something that's a predator that just takes a bite of flesh. You know, like there's some kind of fish and things that do this. They're just like, I'm not gonna kill you and eat you, I'm just gonna come up and just bite you, a chunk of flesh and then go away. And so maybe vampire bats were doing that. Maybe they were carnivorous, but there's a number of carnivorous bats. Maybe they were like one of these carnivorous bats. And then instead of having to kill the animal, you just bite a chunk and then it gets smaller and smaller. And now it's just the blood. I mean, we don't know because there's no proto vampire bat. There's vampire bat fossils. And then there's things that are not vampire bats.
Yeah.
We don't have some kind of intermediate. And even if we did, who knows? We wouldn't know the behavior.
Aren't most vampire bat fossils like some part of their head? Is that
sounds right. I mean, because it's, and even if it, so now I'm talking way outside of my area of expertise, but I would imagine that those are probably also the kinds of bones that you would even be able to know it's a vampire bat. I mean, vampire bats have very distinctive skulls and jaws and teeth. I mean, they almost don't even have very many. I mean, they don't have very many teeth, and the teeth are very distinctive. Whereas if there was a vampire bat, finger bone, I'm not sure that somebody could be like, this is a vampire bat. So that's also an issue there.
Yeah. Well, one other question, because I am very curious about this, and this is almost completely shifting gears. How does one go about starting a lab? Like, so you founded the Carter Lab in 2018. What does that even, like, for a layperson like me, I hear start a lab and I think like, okay, buy some lab coats, get some beakers and other glassware, like rent a space to put it all in and like start doing experiments. Is it as simple as that? Or is there more to it? Or what is
it? Yeah, I mean, everybody who's basically a tenure track assistant professor is expected to start a lab. Meaning that you're now advising graduate students. And so the whole sort of academic path is that, so you do your undergraduate, then you go through graduate school, you could do a master's and a PhD, or maybe in the US, people sometimes skip a master's and just go straight to a PhD.
I only found that out recently, and that blew my mind. I had no idea that that was even a thing.
That you could skip
a master's and go to like straight. This is a high school graduate here, right? Like I didn't go to college. So it was like, the academic path was a mystery to me, but I saw somebody say it on Twitter and I was like, back it up just a second. You said what? You can just do a PhD and skip the master's? That's crazy to me. But continue.
Yeah. I mean, so, and it differs between Europe and the United States. So in Europe, people will do almost always do a master's and then do a PhD, but the PhD could be really short. It could be like 3 years.
Yeah.
Whereas a PhD in the United States could be like 7 years. And so you're in school for a really long time. And then when you pop out and you get your PhD, you usually do, if you're going to do the tenure track direction, which means that you're trying to do research and teaching and, basically do research as a career in addition to teaching, then you might do one or two what are called postdoctoral fellowship. So basically you're working as a professional researcher, but in someone else's lab. Mm-hmm. And postdocs, from the standpoint of the person running the lab, are like a fully functional scientist. So they show up, and often they have these skills they can do because they did a whole PhD. And so then you can like put them on a problem and be like, work on this. And then they can just start working. You don't have to like train them as much, is the idea. So after doing one or two of these postdocs, then you could be an assistant professor and then associate professor and then a full professor. And that whole point where you're a professor, your job has shifted from just doing the research to now it's like, it's actually too many things. It's kind of ridiculous. I don't actually understand how this works. I mean, it's just way too much. So you've got to, you basically now run a lab where you have to train graduate students, supervise postdocs, get these large grants to then get money for everybody, but also you're doing your own research and also you're teaching, also you're supposed to do service. And it's just kind of insane. It's like too much work. Everyone will tell you that is in that situation.
You're like, man, I just really want to go back to being the field assistant again.
Yeah, I think at every stage I pretended when I would apply to the next stage, I would say, oh yeah, I'm ready to do this. Like, I'm so excited. But at every stage, I was being dragged, kicking and screaming from my previous. I mean, when I was an undergraduate field assistant, I was like, I just want to do this forever. And when I was a graduate student, I was like, I want to be a graduate student forever. I mean, it was just amazing. I loved it. I in fact, if I could go and just do a PhD over again, I would. I loved being a graduate student. It was like you're just learning the whole time. And it's just this period of your life, and just explore all these ideas. You're not responsible. Like, people just, you have a small stipend. You don't get paid that much, but basically you have a lot of freedom to do what you want. And then when you're a postdoc, it's amazing. So 100% of your time is just doing research. So you just, you know, every day you wake up, you're just doing research, doing the science, and then that's it. And that's also, I was very sad to give that up. And then when you're a professor, now you're like the leader of a team. And so you have to do a lot of administrative stuff. You've got to write recommendation letters for people. You got to train people. You got to like have a budget. You got to like manage money. It's like running a small business, basically. And I'm starting to enjoy it now, but it's a hard transition to make because you at every stage, it's like the stuff that you become competent at gets ripped away from you. Right. It's just when you get to the point where you're like, I can do this. Like, I can, you know, when you're a graduate student, basically what happens during that time is you go from reading to producing. You go from like, you're reading books and papers and you're learning, you're like learning all these facts about how things work. And then what's expected to happen is you go from that to being a person who writes papers. So you have a question and then you learn everything that there is to know about this question. Then you move the research forward by you collect data. Now you resolve some puzzle or some question and you write this up in the paper. And then you publish that and it's very exciting. It's like, oh my God, now I'm in the permanent scientific record. Like, there's my first paper where I discovered this or I did this. And that's the whole point of graduate school is to like develop that ability. And as soon as you are able to do that, academia is basically like, now you have to do that way more. And then as soon as you get good at doing that, people are like, now you have to like get $1 million grant. I mean, it's just, like, it's just, you're always, and I guess that's part of science too, is when you're doing research, you're always doing something you have no idea what you're doing. As soon as you are competent at it, you're moved on and you're doing something else. And then the whole field is moving. So you could have spent, you know, 5 years of your life learning how to use the microscope. You're like the only person you can use some fancy microscope. And then suddenly it's like, that microscope's outdated. Now we have a new one. Now it's totally different. And now all the stuff you just learned is old fashioned. It's bunk. You got to start over. Got to start learning these new things. And that's just happening all the time.
Yeah. Which is like, it's like the curse of living right now at some level. Because it's just like all this interconnectedness that we have, like things are just developing so rapidly at every level. Like it like nothing is left untouched by this reality. I was talking to my wife the other day. It was like even fashion, you know, like fashion, and it's like a fashion trend that might last like half a decade or a full decade at one point in human history. It's like we're going through decades worth of evolution in fashion in like a year's time now. Just everything just goes so quickly because we're all seeing and like feeding off of each other across the board. And so it's hard. And like even my, you know, my own trade, plumbing, which I am a plumber by trade. I don't know if you knew that or not, but which makes a lot of sense. You know, the bats and plumbing, it's like, it goes hand in hand. Tools are being developed like crazy to do jobs. You encounter scenarios that it's like, we don't really have a tool to accomplish this. So you have to use these five. Well, tomorrow there's going to be a tool that comes out that takes the place of these five tools, so you can get this one job done with just this one tool. And plumbing is actually notorious for that. It's like there are so many highly specialized things that you might use once in your entire plumbing career. But if you don't have it, like, you're kind of screwed. Like you kind of either got to have the 10 to replace the one, or you just don't get the job done. And so, yeah, I can see how that could be very almost mind-numbingly frustrating to encounter that, especially in the scientific world where it's like, there's so many unanswered questions that we have yet to answer. And this allows me to answer it, but not as good as this new thing does.
Right. And it just keeps going. And it also is so specialized. And I think, thinking about plumbing is similar, because I just think about how if you go back in time and people could just, they had like general skills, like they could, you know, a lot of people were like handy and could do things. And I just think to myself, like the amount of stuff that I know is so specialized. And I just think about like, you know, my father or something, and he could fix things in the car and probably do some basic kind of like plumbing stuff or do some handy kind of things. And I am just like incapable of doing like these general things. And I think this is also the case in a lot of fields of science where things become so specialized that there's people who are just, you know, my whole thing is this particular technique, this particular kind of analysis, this particular species, you know, it's, and there's just so much knowledge that's just spread out across so many people. And now you just have so many more teams of people that study things. But yeah, it's increasingly hard to keep up with the amount of information. There's so much information and you're just swimming through a sea of information. You're just trying to stay afloat on the field. And like right here, I've got all these. These are books. These are all books that I'm actually trying to read, like at the same time, on statistics, which is like, I have my whole life I've studied statistics, and I just read this book right now. It's called Statistical Rethinking, and it's just destroying my entire world because I have to rethink everything. It's just like all these things that everyone's doing are outdated. These are like the new ways of doing things, and I'm often telling my graduate students, like, everyone in my lab has to like learn how to write code. I mean, that's now become pretty much a prerequisite. And a lot of the older faculty don't know how to program. And, you know, at some point that just became this thing where everyone has to be able to do that. And
yeah,
there's so many things like that.
Yeah. This book is doing to you what you did to all those people who were trying to say that mutual altruism was right. It's just the universe's way of getting you back, sucker.
Right. Yeah.
Man, that's funny. Yeah, the comparisons. Gosh, yes. Some of the older plumbers who like don't use some of the newer software that we use to keep track of, you know, invoicing and all the stuff that we use it for. It's like they have such a hard time, but it has become just part of that. It's just part of the air that you breathe. Like if you're gonna get into this thing, it's just the reality. Like, I keep using the word reality. That has come up a lot during this conversation, but that is the reality. It is what it is. Like, if you want to do this, you have to know this and this and this. So what are some things that you have to learn that don't necessarily have anything to do with like vampire bats themselves specifically that then enable you to actually study the vampire bats?
I spent a lot of time thinking about statistics. I spent a lot of time thinking about social network analysis, which is basically, you can think about it in two ways. One is that how is it that we understand this very complicated structure, which is individuals all connected to each other in different ways? It's a very complicated model of the system. So a typical model of a social system would just be groups, right? So we'd say, oh, we've got, you know, this is one group, this is another group. And inside that group, it's just homogenous. There's no structure. We just take the average of whatever's in that group, right? That's like saying, you know, and then that's pretty simple. But now we're starting to look within these groups and being like, okay, every relationship is different and could be measured and can be, and then is changing over time. And how do we analyze statistically that those kinds of data? Because again, I mean, this is what I was just saying about with this book, like Statistical Rethinking. One of the ways that we usually analyze data in biology is we collect a lot of independent observations. So you go out, you get a sample of let's say you like collect a bug or something, and then you go and you collect another bug and then another bug. And each of these bugs is supposed to be an independent observation. And so you can count them up and sort of say, now I'm going to make an inference about this bug in general. The problem with social behavior is that nothing is independent of anything. So all the animals are connected to each other. If I was, for instance, doing a study on a drug, I could give either the drug or a placebo to every bat independently. If I have 20 bats, I have 20 observations. But what if I want to study how the bats get along with each other in a group setting? Every time one bat grooms another bat, it's potentially affecting every other bat, because now this bat's not grooming that one. And that if this relationship becomes stronger over here, that could potentially affect every other relationship. So it's like this nightmare of like, how do we even understand a system that's like that and has all these complexities where you've got everything is affecting everything else? So that's like one thing that I spent a lot of time trying to think about and try to, there's so many pitfalls. There's debates about the best way to do this. And like, some people are like, don't do it this way, do it this way. And other people will say, you know, the opposite. Another thing that I'm dealing with is like, we have these new technologies that we're using. There's this a guy named Simon Ripperger who's also on Twitter. You might have interacted with him.
Yeah, we follow each other. He's a postdoc at your lab, right?
Yeah, he was, but it's a funny thing because he was actually kind of like the senior postdoc in the lab that I joined when I was a postdoc. And so if anything, he's like more experienced than me, or we're like peers.
Wow.
And so what happened when we met in Panama, he had this amazing technology that had been developed, and I was working on the vampire bats, and he approached me and was like, we should like track. So these are proximity loggers, like little computers we glue on the bats, and then every 2 seconds, the loggers talk to each other and get basically an estimate of the distance between them. So you basically have the social network in real time as a measure of distance. Bats are close versus far, and we just can map that and track that over time as long as the loggers stay attached to the bats, which is like more than a week. And so we realized like there's so many things we could do with this. We could study the social structure of vampire bats. We could study how those relationships change over time. We could study a network and then look at like how pathogens might transmit over the network, or what happens if a bat gets sick? How does its position the network change? I mean, there's just tons of things. And what happened is that we started collaborating together. I've actually almost like, basically I quit 2 postdocs in order to work with Simon. I mean, I really went all in on this. I was very excited about this idea of working with him. And I think I don't know if we ever discussed this, but I kind of feel like we had an agreement that, you know, since we're both struggling, being a postdoc is a very uncertain time, because that's the biggest bottleneck. It's very hard to get a job as a professor. There's very few jobs, but there's a lot of postdocs. And so I think we both had this agreement that is like, if one of us gets a job, we're going to hire the other one so we can keep working together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he applied for like there was this big, like multi-million-dollar grant in Europe that he thought was going to come through, and then it didn't. And then suddenly he didn't have like a position. Around the same time, I got a job at Ohio State University. So it was great, because then we could just keep working together, and then I just hired him. I basically said, I'll just hire you forever as long as you want. And now he has a job in Germany. He has a permanent job. Postdoc is not a permanent job. It's only like 2 years at a time. You could keep renewing it, but it's not really a stable position. And so he has this position actually doing like very conservation relevant biology in Germany, which is where he always wanted to be. He wanted to stay in Berlin even.
Yeah. He said, I quoted him actually on Twitter the other day, cause he had that one brilliant line, and there was just like a random news outlet, I think it was from Borneo, about how vampire bats, this goes back to the whole anthropocentric view of bats. He said that they don't need to benefit us to deserve to exist or something like that. And I was like, oh, that is so beautiful. Yeah. Because it kind of gets away from that framework, that narrative of like, it has to benefit me in some way. When in fact it appears that like, actually we're benefiting them, but perhaps not the other way around. Like, are there, do the vampire species, do they provide any, is there any discernible human benefit to them?
I mean, a common one that people will mention, like this is one that like Merlin Tuttle would bring up, is that they have an anticoagulant in their saliva, which has been Dracula. Used to, it's been used to treat stroke patients. So there's like a biomedical benefit. And so that's an example of like, here's a species you might think has nothing, there's nothing they can do to benefit people. But then we realize like, oh, there's actually, there's biomedical value in the species that we wouldn't have been able to predict. And I think this is a general truism, is that in general, it's every species is valuable because even if we're thinking about it only as like their economic value to people, there might be this value just in the information within their genome, right? Within the genome of every organism is a like evolutionary history leading up to that point of all of the ancestral problems and all of the like complexities of how exactly you make that organism. And when we lose that lineage, we lose all of that information and all of the things of like the recipes of how you make the proteins and and there's just so much information that's inside of living things that we lose when we lose them, in addition to just like the beauty of the living thing, the inherent value of the living thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the one that people will often say is like, oh, like this anticoagulant. But again, like that's such a common question that I get. And I don't know how to answer it, because I feel like if I answer it that way, it's sort of saying like, yeah, that's the value of living things is.
Yeah. You kind of like, give in, you like capitulate a little bit.
The material value that we get from them.
You almost want to leave it unanswered. It's like, I actually don't really care, because I don't want to like subscribe to that framework necessarily.
It's an interesting philosophical question to have somebody be like, well, what's the value of vampire bats to people? And you can say, well, what's the value of people to, you know, some other, what's the value of people to ants or whatever? I
mean, right.
It's maybe there isn't, you know, but it's not so much there's nothing wrong with asking the question, what's the value of bats to people? What is often a strange question that I get is like the assumption that for vampire bats to have evolved, it was for some purpose, like in the ecosystem, right? Like this is a common idea that people have, is like every animal is serving some role. Like the job of the butterfly is to bring the pollen to the flower. The job of the, you know, everything is like kind of plain. And then people are like, well, what are vampire bats supposed to be doing? And it's like, well, they're not supposed to, they're doing their vampire bat thing is what they're doing.
I will wrap this up. Let me ask two, it's the same question, but from two different directions. What is your favorite bat fact that like blows your mind when you think about it or consider it? And then what is your favorite bat fact to give to other people when they ask you, you know, because like there's something that'll blow your mind, but like you have a lot of context for understanding it, and it wouldn't necessarily hit the same to like a random person.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite, and then what's your favorite to give to somebody who doesn't have the vast wealth of knowledge to pull from that you do?
Oh my goodness. That's a good question. That's a hard question. I have things that are popping up. So to fully answer this question, I might have to like
just spitball, Jerry. Just spitball.
Yeah. That's right. Like I'd have to like sit and actually think about it, because there's so many things like that. The first thing that popped in my mind was something discovered by a friend of mine, Aaron Corcoran, which is that bats jam each other's sonar. Which wild. Is a thing that, you know, there was a hypothesis for a really long time that moths jam bat sonar, and people had sort of went back and forth. It was one of these like cool little scientific controversies, because there was it was basically a team that was saying moths are just warning bats that they taste bad, and there was someone else who's saying moths are just trying to startle a bat so they can try and make a scale. Like, why do moths make these sounds? That was like the question. And then some other people were like, maybe moths are jamming bat signals. It turns out that like it's probably all of the above. I mean, there's moths that are that are in fact warning bats that they're not palatable. But then there are other moths that do in fact jam bats. And this is like this major achievement. And Aaron was the person who really like demonstrate this very well. And then just sort of, and so that was a thing that had been around for a while. Nobody was imagining that bats jam each other. Like, that wasn't a thing that people thought, hey, I wonder if bats do that. Cause it's just like, we like what? Like,
right. Right.
Like, what would that even look like? And he just noticed it. He just noticed there were these calls that, and I remember this cause he presented it at a lab meeting. He was we were at the same, we were both at University of Maryland for a brief period of time. I think he was a postdoc and I was a PhD student. And there were these calls that looked like they could do the job of jamming bat. Like if you overlaid them on top of a series of bat calls, they could make it very hard for the bat to use sonar. And that was sort of his argument, is like just kind of this idea of like, just look at the shape and the design of these calls is like perfectly for this. And I think if you just look at how they're acting, it looks like they're jamming each other's calls. And I actually was skeptical. I just thought like, that's too crazy. Like, how could nobody notice that? Right. How can it be that bats are out there flying around jamming each other call? And no, like people have been watching bats a long time.
They're just
time.
Like trying like, to piss each other off. Like what, what's the function of it? Like what's.
Well, the idea was that by jamming one bat, jamming another bat's call, it could then grab the insect that one was going after.
Oh, it's that's like, the, I see. Okay. You see it. Now I see it. I want it. You can't
I'm
have
stealing
it.
Ah! Yeah. It's so they could steal it from me. They could steal food from each other. That's the whole thing.
So petty.
So he provided evidence for this. And I remember feeling like kind of a jerk because I was like, but can you jam, like, can you take those calls and then jam the bat itself? Like, can you use that to jam a bat? And he was like, well, I haven't done that. I was like, well, I'll believe it if you do that. And then he submitted it. And then the reviewers, so he submitted to Science, and the reviewers of Science were like, can you jam the bat? So the next summer he went down and then did exactly that. He had the calls. He jammed other bats' calls with the call that he recorded. That just seals the deal. And he came back and he published it. And I was just like dude, it's true. They jam each other's calls. And so I love that discovery because it's just such a cool, like, it's such an amazing thing to have discovered. It must have been very satisfying to discover something like that.
Yeah.
I'm just, in terms of like just favorite little bat facts I like to tell people. One of my favorite is, you know, this is bat. Well, you know this quite well because you might have single-handedly been responsible for more people knowing about this bat than like anyone in the world, which is this bat in New Zealand that, right? This New
the
Zealand
sky
bat.
Hobbit.
Yes. This New Zealand bat, which evolved in an environment where there's like no other mammals. So it runs around on the ground like a mouse or a shrew. It buries, goes on a leaf little, it like lives, it will like, people found them in like rotten logs. They're like lined up like peas in a pod, like inside the log. They have a long tongue to go into flowers to feed from this flower that they're like the specialized pollinator for. But then they also like wrap it up tree. They just have this hugely expanded niche where they just do all the things that other mammals do in other places. And then their wings fold into these little leathery pouches.
It's like little like scrolls on the side of their body.
Yeah. And then they run around and unlike vampire bats run on the ground and they kind of run, but what they really do is just walk really fast and then they're kind of sloppy. Or at least that's what Dan showed with his like nice little, his amazing videos where he's got like, here's a vampire bat running. It looks like it's doing flying push-ups. It's just like launching itself in the air over and over again. It's like a series of jumps. And now here's the, is, you know, Mr. Cena's a little bat and it looks like a chicken nugget with like toothpicks on the side, just like going like this as fast as it can. It's like, it looks like it's tripping over itself. And so they don't like change gaits, but they can move really fast on the ground and they really do spend a lot of time on the ground. But it seems that like, because they're no predators. So vampire bats are in a situation where they're very vulnerable to predators. In fact, every time they're feeding, there's a possibility of this animal just like rolling over on them and getting squished. And then there's all kinds of like snakes, you know, cats can get vampire bats. And so when they're creeping up to something, they are so cautious. I don't know if you've ever seen videos of them feeding on stuff, but they are like, it's like they're sneaking up like, this is, I'm doing the most dangerous. It's like a cat thief. you know, in a museum with like the lasers, and they're just like creepy. Yeah, they're little ninjas. And the minute something goes wrong, they launch so fast, they're gone. They're out of there. So this other bat, New Zealand bat, it's got its wings in there. And it's like, if it wants to like take off the ground, it's like, they got this wing at one, two. And like
slowly unfurl. Like,
yeah. And so they've just been no decimated.
Sense of urgency.
I mean, they could, I mean, compare, I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating a little bit, but like in terms of like they're getting decimated by like introduced predator, like rats and weasels and things in New Zealand. And when I was in New Zealand, I didn't realize like how conservation New Zealand is all about killing mammals. And so I remember I was hitchhiking and I got in a car with a couple, and there was some mammal that like, so basically every time you see a mammal, it's like this invasive thing that's destroying their environment. There's some, I don't even remember what it was. Something was crossing the road and they swerved and the wheel went ka-chunk.
Who hit it?
They ran over it. And then they high-fived each other. And I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, landed in like crazy country?
It's funny because I did an episode with Ben Paris, and so we were talking a little bit about Predator Free New Zealand and sort of that initiative. And I asked him, I said, so basically, it's like open season 24/7 in New Zealand right now for like everything but this bat, right? And he was like, kind of, yeah. And I was like, but surely there's like regulated methods that are like, it's approved that you can get rid of them this way. But like, cause like what I immediately imagine is like a bunch of people with like pitchforks and torches, just like, you know, kill the mammals, you know? And you almost kind of just confirmed that a little bit though. Cause it's like, yeah, we're just gonna, you're like 10 points. Good job.
It's surreal. I was like, what just happened?
Crazy. But
like, have you seen that documentary about cane toads?
No,
there's an old quirky documentary about cane toads in Australia. So cane toads are these giant toads that are found, like they have them in Panama, and in Australia they just were introduced there, and they're just wreaking havoc on the environment, going around everywhere. And there's just this old documentary that's quirky and kind of funny. It's about these cane toads.
But no, it was a cane toad that picture I've posted it a couple times now, but that picture of a frog or a toad with a bat in its mouth, the bat wings hanging out of its mouth, that was a cane toad, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah,
they just kind of, I guess it's just like bleh, like right afterwards, and the bat was fine. But pretty crazy what they can fit in that gaping mouth of theirs. So Mysticina, that's your, and what is it about it specifically that is what you like to clue people into? Just that it's like the only native mammal of New Zealand?
Yeah, just the whole story of how weird of a bat it is. And that, I think it's a nice example of how like, you know, if you've got an evolutionary history that just went off in a different direction, because it's its own family. And it has all these weird traits, and it, the whole story of what it's like just makes sense given the environment that it evolved in.
Yeah.
And so I that's just, and I just feel like it used to be the case that like nobody had even heard of this bat. Right. It was just, I know about it because I actually wrote a review paper about it when I was an undergraduate. And I just had so much fun like reading these old papers. It was a review paper for a journal called Mammalian Species, where you basically have to go back to the original. So I had to go back to like when it was discovered and get the original like book, and you have to sort of follow everything about this animal from the moment it was first described up until now, and just try to review everything in a very complete way. And that was also interesting too. Sorry to go off on a quick tangent, but reading these old papers. So this bat's highly endangered now, but some of the early papers when they're first describing it, it was like, we wanted to study this bat. So we found like the only roost of it that we knew of, and we started a fire inside the roost. And then as they flew out, what? we hit them with sticks, and we killed as many as we could, but it was only like 100 or something. And it is funny, like reading old scientific papers and the way that people used to study animals. It would just be like, I'm going to go study this animal. So I got my shotgun and I'm just going to see how many I can get. That's like a sort of a thing I enjoy is old papers and old books that talk about bats before echolocation was discovered. There's one I found in an antique store just recently. It was like the book of nature study, and it had a whole section on bats. I was reading the section. It was like, you know, bats, the way they get around at night is that they feel things with their wings. Like they have little hairs on their wings. And as they fly around, they like feel where they are in the complete darkness. And I just thought like, yeah, I guess like that's probably the best explanation you could have before you discovered sonar. Like yeah. Probably in the 1920s or something.
Well, and that's it. I'm looking right now. I just, some of the early experiments, I say early, like 1800s, there was a Catholic priest who kind of almost like drove himself mad trying to figure out like, how is it that these bats are navigating in the darkness? And so like would blind them, like took needles yeah. and like literally blinded them and like would stuff their ears full of hot wax to try to just make something happen that like gave right. them explanatory power as to how they were navigating in complete darkness. Like they see with sound, like what is this?
Yeah.
And then it wasn't until Donald Griffin, was that his name? He discovered yeah. echolocation.
Yeah.
And I actually have a copy of his book on its way to me right now. I'm interested to see, interested to read that, but,
listening in the dark.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yep. That's the one. So,
Spallanzani's problem where he concluded that bats see with their ears and people were like, you should retire. Like, he was like, he had discovered all this
stuff. Keep doing
the
priest thing and like give up the whole like.
Well, he had a reputation of doing like some really excellent science. And then I think this is like an embarrassment was that he just went with where the science led him. And he's like, they use their ears to see somehow. And people were like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I got nothing.
I mean, another one that's like that, sorry to go off on a brief, I just love this so much, is when, I forget who it was, but the guy who was one of the people who was trying to understand, like, how it was always just assumed that plants, like, make themselves out of water and soil, right? So, like, a tree is growing mass, getting heavier and heavier, and this guy is, like, trying to document that, so he's giving soil and giving water, he's measuring exactly how much he's giving it. And instead it's like growing way too heavy for the amount of soil and water. And now we know the answer is that it just would have been unbelievable, but it's like plants actually eat air. Like they make themselves out of thin air. That's what they're doing. They're fixing carbon out of the air, and all of the leaves and the trunk, that's all made out of air. But at the time, this like this guy must have been going crazy. Like, I'm measuring every material I'm giving this plant, and somehow it is just growing in size without any. You know, at that time, like I'm sure they understood like conservation of matter and all this, but like this must have been insane.
Yeah,
and it's when both of those cases, the actual explanation is so fantastical, right? To explain to this person, like actually. Plants are it's taking the air and it's making a leaf out of that, and that would have been like what. And it's the same thing with the bat explanation. It's actually it's sending sounds out, the echoes are bouncing off, and then it's hearing that, and then it's seeing with that, and it's all at a frequency that you guys haven't discovered yet, but there's all these sounds that you don't hear but the bats can hear. I mean, it's
also
I love
let's
it.
Talk about frequency for a second. Let's explain that. Yeah, no, it's it would seem like magic. I mean, it's the same concept of like these like boxes that we stare into, and somehow it's so completely inexplicable to somebody from 100, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, you know? And it almost seems like, it reminds me of that, I think it's like the first Thor movie, where, Natalie Portman's character like goes to Asgard and is like, you guys have magic. And he's like, well, what you call magic, we call science. And it's like, there's actually some truth to that. You know, it's like things that we can explain through science now did seem like magic to the ancient
yeah.
mind.
Yeah. And even it's almost magic to us because we often don't know how these things work, right?
Like, yeah.
I don't know what's going on in an iPad and how that all happens, but the effect is amazing. Like the fact that these things, yeah, I just, I really like, that's one of the things I like about the jamming paper too. It's just, it's one of these fantastical discoveries. It just changes the whole way you think about this. When you think about bats flying around, you're thinking like, oh, they're looking after insects or chasing insects. You're not imagining they're like stealing each other's insects and jamming each other's. It's like adds a whole dimension. Yeah. It's the thing I've always wondered about bats is like, to what extent do they understand every other individual around them from their echolocation calls? I mean, can they, you have, to what extent, we know that a bat can hear another bat's echolocation calls and be like, that bat's over there is munching on something and I'm going to go over there. They eavesdrop on each other. But when a vampire bat's sitting in the complete darkness of its roost and everybody's looking around, means they're calling, they're using sonar. Is it like, I know where everyone is in the same way as like when you and I just scan the room and we instantly know where everybody is? Like, do they have that sensory perception of every individual's position from the sound of the individual? Right? Like, that's the thing. I don't know. I don't, because their whole social life is inside these completely dark cavities. But it's you can imagine a whole bunch of different scenarios of what that's like. It could be like something like, if we were in a dark room, you would eventually figure out who's around because we would recognize everyone else's voices, right? But that's not the same as like turning the lights on, right? So for vampire bats in the dark, is it like us being in the dark where we could eventually figure out like, hey, Joe, is that you? Oh, okay. Yeah, you're over there. Who am I bumping up against? And then, you know, then they say something. It's like, oh, that's Anne. I recognize her voice, right? So their voices, but do they recognize each other's echolocation calls to such an extent that they just instantly know, like, that it's actually the social information they have is as rich as like us sitting around in the daytime?
Yeah.
That's like a thing I don't really understand. And I said, there's so many things like that. Like, we don't even really understand how individualized the relationships are of different bats, how complex their social, we don't know what kinds of like social knowledge vampire bats have. We don't know to what extent they have relationships that are socially complicated in the way that primate relationships are, where like, for, I'll give you an example, like with primates, if you play the sound of a infant, the other like baboons will look at the mom. Right. So they have this knowledge of like, I know who that is. That's the infant of this, you know, mom. And now I'm going to look over the mom because I expect her to respond to that. I mean, that's a level of social information that we take for granted, but to what extent do different animals have that kind of understanding of the social world? I don't know. If I could just understand some of these things before I die, you'll just be so satisfied. Yeah. If I could just resolve the reciprocity thing. If I could show that vampire bats do in fact regulate their relationships in this way, where like they seek out good partners and avoid bad partners and that sort of thing. If I really show that conclusively in such a way that everyone in the field is like, yes, they do that, then I will feel satisfied with my scientific legacy, because I've been working on that forever and I still haven't managed it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we've learned about vampire bats in the meantime. And I think the evidence for that is accruing, but I still like haven't had the like completely convincing experimental demonstration, because relationships are just very hard to manipulate.
Yeah. Do you think that experiment, which you've alluded to previously and just now, do you think that experiment will be like, is that the one? Is that the concluding experiment? Like, if we set this up and we're able to manipulate these relationships in we're able to call the shot on the pool table, right? 8-ball corner pocket, and then it happens. Is that the one? Is that the one that you go, yes, this is what I've been trying to prove this whole time?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it will be a thing that I will feel like, okay, I am now satisfied that I have demonstrated that. And I will probably start to move on to other things and build on top of that. But I feel like there is still room to doubt this. I mean, everything that I think is along a spectrum of certainty, right? And there's certain things that like, I'm pretty certain that vampire bats recognize each other as individuals. So there might be someone who doesn't believe that, but I'm satisfied enough that I'm not going to keep studying that, because I've done some experiments that there's evidence for that, but you could keep being skeptical about it, but I've moved on. And so this question of like, whether they are weighing different individuals differently and sort of rewarding or punishing or choosing good partners, that's something that there's still some controversy around. And I feel like that's somewhat still justified. Like, I feel like there's more work to be done. So for me, that'll be the experiment. So for instance, that experiment I just told you about with the monkey with the treasure chest, I mean, I think that's a beautiful experiment that really demonstrates basically partner choice based on the quality of this individual being a potential food provider.
Yeah.
So that's basically doing something like that with Vanford Vets is still what I would still like to do that. And then the other questions I have are sort of built on top of that. Like, I have this hypothesis called social bet hedging, which is very far. So on the spectrum of certainty, this is maybe the far of all the ideas that I have. This is maybe one of the farthest along. Like, I could be totally wrong about this. I could be wrong. I think there's good evidence for it. I think it makes sense, but it is nowhere near like a conclusive thing.
Proven. Yeah.
Yeah. So what social bet hedging is the idea that the bats are not only like trying to build these reciprocal relationships, but actually that there's a trade-off between quantity and quality. So if you think about human friendships, you could have a few really close friendships, or you could have a lot of weak friendships, and that your strategy in terms of whether you're going to try to build few close relationships or many weak relationships is going to depend on how stable your social environment is. So if you're in a situation where individuals are coming and going, or you don't know when they're going to be there or not in any given moment, that's going to move you towards wanting to have more relationships. Because if you, for instance, if a vampire bat has a really amazing relationship with its mother, and that's its only relationship, you take mom away, now that bat has no food donors. You know, so I've actually done these experiments, so this is where I think this is true. But on the other hand, maybe it's better to have fewer closer relationships than a bunch of fair weather friend type relationships. You're not particularly close with any of them. And there's some evidence for people that there's a kind of balancing thing with people where if you ask most people that they tend to prefer to want to have fewer, stronger relationships. And that seems to be like really what's most of the benefit of social life comes from that. But when people live in environments where there's a lot more sort of social mobility, you think about something like college where people are coming and going and everything's changing, the social environment's changing a lot, that might push people towards having more friends. So if I have one best friend, I need to make sure I have other friends. I have backup friends. And for vampire bats, this means having relationships outside the family, right? So you start with your family, with your mother, and you have that relationship, but at some point you want to start building these other relationships. And how do you decide at what point how you balance those two things, quality and quantity? And social bet hedging, the reason it's called that is the idea is that bet hedging is like, I'm going to have backups. Like, it's like you invest in the stock market. I know this is my best stock, but I'm going to like diversify my stock. I'm going to buy these other stocks just in case this one like totally tanks. I've got these other ones. And that's what I think is happening with vampire bats, is that they're always trying to like start these new relationships. Like, why did they even start new relationships, right? If a bat is in there and has a food sharing partners, why is it going over and like finding some bats not related to and being like, hey, want to groom? Like, what's the point of that? So I think, and this is a little very tenuous, but I think what's happening is that animals are essentially assessing how well connected they are and trying to maintain a kind of optimal amount of connectedness and trying to balance. Like, I've got this one really good friend, but you know what I could use is like a few more friends. Or there might be bats that are doing the opposite of saying, you know, I got a lot of friends, but none of my friends are really like, I'm their best friend. So I want to really have more of a best friend, spend more time with this one individual. I think, so that's the idea, is that that's actually going on. Now, is that going on? I don't know. I mean, it makes sense to me that it would be, but
sure,
it's a lot of work to be done to test that idea.
Yeah. For every good question that you want to ask, there's like it seems like there's five questions that have to be answered before you can even like reasonably ask that question. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yes. There's a, luckily our ability to like track relationships is so improved by these technologies, but then we also need to figure out what we're even getting from the technologies, right? So historically what I've been doing is videotaping grooming and food sharing. And now we have this other way where it's like automated. We can put proximity loggers, but that's a different thing. Like being at the same place at the same time is not the same thing as
necessarily. Yeah.
Yeah.
Show it's not what the same activity is just that they're close to each other.
But could it be that, you know, I think that what we're really studying is a relationship is manifesting itself in different ways, right? So you don't have, you have friends. You don't have, this is my drive me to work friend. This is my, you know, we eat together friend. You, in my mind, like the definition of a friendship is that you can engage in different, you could easily go from, we're playing chess, now we're playing tennis, now we're hanging out and having and laughing, and now I had a terrible day and now I'm getting support from you. So there's all these different things we're doing together, and it makes sense because there's a general affiliation there. And so that's also kind of a thing of what I think is going on with the vampire bats. I think that, and we have some evidence for that now. It's going to come out like any day now. So we did this, it's actually, there's a preprint, but we showed that the bats are sharing food with each other. They're also like social foraging together. So they're hunting, they're meeting each other out on these hunts. Which is not necessarily what you'd want to do if your whole thing was like, I only relate to you via food sharing. Then if it was just a food sharing system, then it might make sense that everybody would hunt separately so that you maximize the area that you're covering and then come back to the roost and share food. But it seems the bats want to, they're also hunting. I mean, it might be the case that they're sharing the cow. You go out there, hey, there's a bunch of bats. I'll let you like feed on the same cow as I'm feeding on, but this other bat, I'm not going to let do that. I think that those kinds of things are probably happening.
Interesting. So, and even another layer of that social dynamic that you're talking about, it's like, oh, well, here's what's happening here.
Yeah. And
they're going out together now.
Right. Yeah. You brought up this dominance thing. I never actually addressed that. So we had a paper on female dominance, and this was kind of interesting, although it was unexpected. In many primates that where there's these matrilines, there is a very steep dominance hierarchy among females, where there's like a whole matriline that is dominant over another matriline. So if there's an alpha female or so dominant female, and you're the daughter of that alpha, you suddenly have the same social status as your mother. Even though you're younger, you're like above another adult, you know, macaque or something. And so we looked for evidence of this in vampire bats. We basically didn't find anything like that. We didn't see any sense that there was like this steep dominance hierarchy. There was dominant structure, meaning that it wasn't completely random who's like, you know, taking food from who or whatever. But basically we looked at displacements and little conflicts over blood feeders. And then I don't remember, it was like 1,000 or something of these. I don't remember, 1,300 observations of this. And it wasn't random, but when you compare them to primates, it's not much of a dominance hierarchy, put it that way. Like it's not clear that certain bats are
cut.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting because in many ways vampire bats seem a lot like these primates, but in other ways they're really different. And I think I like this idea of thinking about how these things are convergent. Like, you know, things like grooming have popped up in all these different species. There's even like a cleaner fish. You know, cleaner fish are these fish that they sort of go up to a larger fish and they'll eat like ticks or dead skin. But there's a whole kind of cooperative thing going on there because the larger fish could just like eat the cleaner fish or chase it away. And the cleaner fish could cheat by, instead of eating like dead skin, could eat live skin, could take a bite of live flesh and then swim away. Right. And so there's a subtle cooperation, and a lot of it is mediated by the cleaner fish will do a little dance and they'll like stroke the larger fish to like, I think to like build up trust. It's like a kind of grooming. So I think it's just crazy to think like fish are in some way like grooming each other, just like monkeys groom each other and vampire bats are grooming each other, but that's got nothing to do with like what monkey. It's like they both came up with these things independently. It's not like this social grooming is something where, I mean, like vampire bats do this way more than other bats. Like it's like an order of magnitude more than other bats. And if you go back to the common ancestor of primates and vampire bats, I don't think there's much of the social grooming going on. But
right.
Vampire bats have invented social grooming and food sharing, and primates are also doing grooming and exchanging grooming for all kinds of things. I like this idea.
They all invented the wheel, but they all did it a little bit differently from one another. And it's like maybe serving like different purposes, but then like kind of the same purposes at the same time.
It's like convergent evolution. It's the same thing with the running vampire bats. That's why people got so excited about that, is that, you know, the ancestors of vampire bats definitely could not run, because bats can barely, they can't really walk. They can kind of crawl. They kind of like drag their bodies on the ground.
Yeah.
And so vampire bats invented running, and it turns out it has all these same properties as like other animals that
other run. Locomotion.
Yeah. But they got there from a completely different place. It's like dolphins and fish, you know, like they have the same design, but dolphins, they're mammals, and they just, their ancestors were completely out of the water. They went back in the water. Suddenly natural selection shapes them into a very fish-like design.
Yeah.
And then sharks, which are their own. It's this, like, evolutionary biologists who are into adaptation, they just love those things. They love convergent evolution, where two things, people think, oh, these two birds are like really closely related. And then it turns out they're not closely related. And it's like the environment gave them the exact same design, which makes you think they're related, but they're actually distantly related.
Yeah. Or like Luna moths, right? Like different species where, gosh, I can't remember where I read that, but there's in two separate parts of the world, their tails, as a way back to like defense mechanisms and the arms race of bats, right? These ones over here evolved these tails, and then these ones over here also evolved these tails.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like the same thing, but the common ancestor did not have these tails. It's so amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So people love those things, because those are the kinds of little, it's like a little story that could go in a book to illustrate this larger principle of convergent evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Another other one I like, sorry to just keep these little maybe this, I'll shut up after this, but another friend of mine, John Ratcliffe, did the study with his advisor at the time, Jeff Galef, showing that vampire bats don't have taste aversions, which are this like basic thing that animals in general are expected to have. Like even mollusks have this, like across the family tree, where what a taste aversion is, if you eat something and then you get really sick and throw up, you don't really want to eat that thing again. It's a really basic.
It's pretty standard.
But the interesting thing, I mean, the thing about it is that a lot of animals do this, and it's not what's called associative learning. So associative learning, you need to have repeated lessons, right? Like, oh, this thing that was red, like it stung me, and then it happened again, and then it happened again, and now I'm forming an association between this. But like a lot of animals form these like taste aversions, just they form like right away.
Mm.
Vampire bats were put a bunch of bats in experiments, and like the fruit bats, they fed on some fruit that made them sick, and it was flavored a certain way, and they're like, I'm never eating that again. The vampire bats were given blood, and some of it was flavored a way that made them sick and throw up, and they like drank it, and then they just went, I'll drink that some more. They just don't care. And the argument is that a vampire bat is never gonna eat spoiled blood. And it might be that they're very vulnerable to it for that reason, because a lot of zoos, you know, have had problems. You could have a whole colony of vampire bats die if the blood goes bad. They drink it, and then it makes them sick, and then they just go, huh, they just drink it more. And so that's an example of where something that, you know, is not being used can be lost. And vampire bats, they're so specialized on blood, and blood is not going to, like, go bad. It's not like they're trying new foods. They're choosing the whole animal. So some vampire bats species specialize in birds and other ones on mammals. But they're not going up to like little dishes of blood in the forest that might've been contaminated.
Right.
So they don't seem to care about whatever novel flavors. They don't even care about temperature. We did a study where even though they use temperature to find blood, they're very sensitive to like temperature differences, and they've got a whole like heat detection system. Once you teach them like there's cold blood, if you can provide them with like body temperature blood next to the cold blood, and they're like, I'll just drink whatever.
I don't care. Give it to me hot. Yeah. Give it to me cold. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Tastes the same, or like maybe not, or actually, I don't care. I don't care how it tastes. I'll just taste and temperature don't matter. Just get it in my mouth. That's all that matters.
And they are sensitive a bit to taste. Like you can add things to the blood that they don't like, and they like the taste of blood. And in fact, they'll eat less of it if you can. I mean, we put things in the blood to keep it from coagulating. They don't like that. But the point is that they don't. If you try to teach them that a particular neutral flavor, like a novel flavor like cinnamon, this means you throw up. But another novel flavor like chocolate means you're just fine. They don't show a preference for chocolate over cinnamon.
I got you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's.
They don't like either one, but then they don't learn anything about it. They just know they don't like it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. The unanswered question. It all comes back to Brock Fenton's quote for me. The unanswered questions about bats is kind of what keeps me in the science, asking the questions, because there's always more. There's always another question, always another quirk that you're like, wait, why? Like why is that not bothering you? Because why are you not learning from that?
Yeah,
because I would. I had one bad Taco Bell experience, and it's no more Taco Bell for me.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Dude, this has been a great time. Thanks for chopping it up with me for however long we've been doing this. 2 hours almost, maybe even more than that. Golly. Thanks to your wife for sacrificing since you get to spend it with me instead. If people want to find you and what you're doing, where can they go? Where can they find more Jerry Carter?
I have a website, socialbat.org. It's kind of a blog too. I don't update it as much as I used to. It actually goes all the way back to when I started my PhD. If you go back in time, you'd see like trying to think about things that I later figured out. So that I kind of kept it as a record. It's a kind of a record of my whole time since my PhD of all the things I've been thinking about and learning about. And I should write more, but I basically use it as a kind of a news feed now. So anytime something new in the lab happens, or if we publish a paper, I post it in the blog.
Yeah. You've got some cool pictures and some good video content linked there as well. Some of your talks.
Yeah. There's a whole page. Cause people ask me a lot for photos or videos of vampire bats. I try to put a lot of stuff there so I can respond to those emails quickly.
Yeah. Well, if anybody's interested in what he's got going on, yeah, go to socialbat.org. He's also on Twitter, occasionally. I actually see a lot of your papers going out there. That seems to be the primary place for me anyway. Are you on Instagram? I can't remember.
Not really. I think I have an Instagram account, but I don't think I've ever even posted it. Yeah. My wife uses Instagram, and then I think I just never got into it.
Yeah. Well, can't get
it. I mean, even my Twitter is basically I just tweet scientific papers that I like want to read, or that I think might be interesting if other people want to read.
You tweet scientific papers and you follow the Bat World Cup. Those are the two things that you use Twitter
yes.
for.
Yeah. Right.
Well, hey, thanks again, man. I appreciate you and what you're doing. I'm really excited to see how this all continues to develop. I'm hoping the same things for you that you're hoping for you, which is I hope these questions get answered. Because now I need the satisfaction of knowing where all this goes and how it all develops. So, yeah, man, thanks for spending time with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this has been really great. I think what you're doing is really valuable.
I'm just a bat.
For the real ones that have made it to the end of this episode, welcome. I hope that you feel that your time was well rewarded, that you have plenty to think about. This conversation, I was there, right? I was there for the conversation. I listened to it a second time when I edited this. I still have so much to process. There's so much happening inside of my brain. There's not a moment of that I didn't enjoy. From the story of when he was a kid all the way through the end. It just, the whole thing just got my brain going. And still does. So go find Jerry on Twitter at Jerry G. Carter. Find me on Twitter if you haven't already at Give Bats a Break. Remember that I've got my website, givebatsabreak.com. There's some merch there. There's actually some really dope vampire bat designs. So if you're juiced on vampire bats after this episode, hit up the website, look for those shirts. It's the Vampire Collection. Get a shirt, a sweatshirt, a hoodie. And all podcasters say this at some point, and so it is cliche, I suppose, but please, go to your favorite platform and leave a review. Really does help. If not the algorithm and visibility, then certainly the morale. Unless it's a bad review, but even then, that's an opportunity for growth, right? So appreciate any comments you might have to offer. You can feel free to reach out to me directly, givebatsabreak@gmail.com. Be happy to hear from you. And I'm really looking forward to the next time you and I get together and we get to Give Bats a Podcast.